Welcome to KPTZ's Nature Now, a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of kptz.org.
Hello, this is Debron Kelso, host of this edition of Nature Now for the third week of October. This week we have as our guest wildlife biologist Patrick Loafman, who will be speaking with us about our local amphibians. He was unable to join us in the studio, but we will be speaking with him by phone later in the program. And I'm hoping that it comes out okay because I'm just at the tail end of a cold and my ears are a little compromised and my voice is a little froggy, but it's appropriate for our topic for my voice to be a little bit froggy today. So anyway, we are also very pleased to have sound engineer Charlie Fleischman here to help us with this week's observations and events. Welcome, Charlie.
Thank you, Debron.
But before we get to that, let's first hear the mystery sound of the week. A big hint for this one is that we will be mentioning this animal in our show today. We'll play the calls again at the end of the program and tell you what makes them. Paula Vanderhuel from Admiralty Audubon posted seeing lots of fall migrants on their walk along the Larry Scott Trail near Cape George Road, the most abundant being 75 American widgeon, 50 ring-necked ducks, and 30 northern shovelers, along with 10 green-winged teal and 8 pied-billed grebes.
Speaking of northern shovelers, which for those of you unfamiliar with them are large, handsome ducks with very large spatulate bills, which they use to strain food out of muddy shallows. Jeff Hammerson sent us some lovely photos of males at Cotai Lagoon, which are gradually molting into their breeding plumage.
He also notes numerous cross orb weaver spiders about, often seen in the center of their large orb webs, just in time to be part of your Halloween party decorations. This species is common in our area, but not native to here, having been introduced from Europe. With the return of moisture to the soil, coast moles have also been on the move, creating vast networks of new feeding tunnels just below the soil surface in grassy meadows, and, to the chagrin of some of you, also in your lawns.
Speaking of Halloween party decorations, Jeff has also been seeing black and orange banded woolly bear caterpillars crossing roads, seeking out places to spend the winter. This is the larval stage of the Isabella tiger moth. Despite folklore, the width of the orange band has nothing to do with the severity of the oncoming winter, but simply increases in size each time the caterpillar molts.
In botanical news, Jeff notes that while many plants are losing their leaves, some plants are still flowering abundantly. These include sea rocket, visited by pollen-laden honeybees, and gumweed, visited by tiny wasps, along Port Townsend Bay. Planted non-native madroño, or strawberry tree, is also flowering, at the same time as it offers ripe and ripening fruits. This is unusual among plants in general, but normal for this species. This is the Mediterranean species for which the Spaniards named our somewhat similar native arbutus. The Spanish in California recognized the similarity of the Pacific Coast species to a different species they knew in Spain, and gave it the same name, madroño, which we have corrupted to madrone or madrona.
And lastly, some very good news sent to us from Al Latham. The summer chum salmon runs in Salmon and Jimmy Come Lately creeks are breaking records for number of adults returning to spawn, with over 6,000 counted so far in each creek. The run in Chimicum Creek hasn't broken records this year, but is experiencing very good numbers. In addition to the habitat improvements made to their spawning grounds, the ocean conditions where they've spent the last 3 years must have been just what they've needed for good survival.
Yahoo! We're fortunate here in the Pacific Northwest to have a rich amphibian fauna with the damp maritime climate of Washington and Oregon, especially hospitable to a variety of frog and salamander species. And as we mentioned earlier, we're very pleased to have Patrick Loafman as our guest this week on Nature Now. Patrick is a wildlife biologist who has worked since 1994 on various projects for the Olympic National Park, from spotted owls to alpine plants, but he's especially knowledgeable about the amphibians of this area. And this is a knowledge that he's here to share with us. Welcome, Patrick.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Oh, it's nice to have you. And I understand that you're so into your subject that you've published a novel with a herpetologist as the protagonist.
Yeah, I figured I haven't read too many novels with herpetologists in there, so I figured I'd better write one. So that's what I did.
Yeah.
I used a lot of my knowledge to try to bring in some of the local amphibians into a story. So, yeah.
Oh, that's cool. So can we get that at, like, the local bookstore, or does it have to be ordered straight from you?
Yeah, you can get it at both local bookstores in Port Angeles and imprint bookstore in Port Townsend.
Oh, cool.
And online.
It's going to be on my fall reading list. It's Somewhere Upriver, is that what it's called?
Yeah, Somewhere Upriver is the novel.
Well, perfect.
And I'm working on a second novel, but it's probably going to take me much time to finish. So.
Oh, well. Well, we'll read the first and wait for the second.
Yes.
So perhaps we should start with having you introduce us to the general groupings of amphibians in our area.
Yeah, to begin with, amphibians begin, if you remember the phylogenetics from high school or not, but to class amphibia. Amphibia has three groups, one of them that doesn't really exist here called the Caecilians, which are weird, blind, worm-like, burrowing amphibians that live in the tropics. But up here we have basically two groups. There's the frogs and there's the salamanders.
Before we go any further, I should ask you to clarify the difference between newts and salamanders. So newts are salamanders, right?
Yeah, they are salamanders. Part of the confusion may go back to that, was that Shakespeare, eye of newt and toe of frog thing, because then people start thinking, is it a type of frog? But it's really a type of salamander. And that's the simplest way to describe it. Newts are basically one family of salamanders. The family name's actually Salamandridae. But if you look at worldwide at all the different members of these newts, they look quite different. They have different behaviors and life histories. There's no real single thing I could really point out to say this is a newt worldwide. So it's basically just one family of salamanders.
So since we've mentioned newts, this would probably be a good time to speak about one of the most familiar of our local amphibians, the rough-skinned newts, which is often seen migrating across our roads on damp days in spring and fall. And they're a favorite of many people. I made newt crossing signs on our road, and they're really adorable to look at, but they're very toxic to eat, right?
Yeah, that's actually really interesting. I also stopped to pick them out of the road because I hate to see those guys get squished. But and they move so slow. They have no chance against a car. But yeah, the rough-skinned newt's probably the most known salamander out here because it's slow-moving. It's also rough-skinned. It can come out during the day and not suffer much from being dehydrated. It has a bright orange belly. It has a neurotoxin called tetrodotoxin. And this is a poison that's actually shared by pufferfish, of all things. Most things can't eat it. The main exception, maybe the only, I'm not sure, is the common garter snake out here. We have two species of garter snakes. The common garter is usually larger and has some red blotches on the side, and the northwestern garter is a little smaller headed, and these are all brown, but it doesn't have the red splotches. The garter snake, the common garter, and the newt is cited as a classic example of a co-evolution, where you've had over time this newt developing a more toxic toxin and the garter snake developing resistance and being able to still eat it.
Hmm.
And there's a lot of variations in the newt, the concentration of poisons in the newts. Some of the initial studies have shown in British Columbia there are some populations of newts that have no toxins. And then some of the most toxic ones have been found, I think, near Corvallis, but one newt could kill 20 humans, full-grown humans.
Wow.
The poison. So, but where you go, the garters have developed resistance. But the most recent research was kind of interesting because it seems like the garter snakes have taken leaps and bounds and developed super resistance to these newts more than they even need. For example, in places where the concentration of the newt poison was low, some of these garter snakes still had enough resistance to eat several newts in the most toxic areas. and some of the genetic work, they found that a small substitution in the genes developed a big leap in resistance to this poison for the garter snakes.
Huh.
So they seem to evolve by much greater leaps, where the newts are a little slower to evolve, partially because when they emit this poison, some of that poison is actually absorbed by the newt, and they're not, they're a little bit resistant, but a lot of it could kill themselves.
Oh, but that being said, it's not dangerous to pick a newt up and take it off the road, right?
It's a poison that, first of all, it can't be absorbed through your skin, so that's not a problem. Some of the poison dart frogs in the tropics, they can absorb through your skin and kill you. But these, they don't, and they don't emit the poison all the time. As I said, it kind of comes at a cost to them to even do that. So if they've been severely agitated, they'll lift their head and their tail and reveal that orange belly. And this orange belly is a warning to predators, don't eat me, I'm poisonous. So if it's in that pose, you might see the poison coming out. And you said you saw that once, didn't you?
I did, only once. And it was really rare. It was in that warning position. And there were just a few teeny little drops on its back that were white and, you know, milky. So I assumed that that was the toxin.
And that probably, most certainly what it is. I've seen them in that pose before, but never really seen them push out the poison. So I think they do that even before they start emitting it.
Uh-huh.
So if you came across a newt that was arched up like that, they call that the Unken reflex. This is actually named after a German fire-bellied toad, of all things. It also has a bright red belly. It's poisonous, and when it gets alarmed, it shows off its red belly too. And the common name for this toad in Germany is Unken, because that's the sound of its call, presumably.
Oh, that's funny.
So that, yeah, and this Unken reflex, the newt does the same thing, and it's the same idea as trying to show off that it is poisonous. So if it was doing that, it'd probably be best to wash your hands. But there was one mortality, and it's been cited a lot. Some 20-year-old guy in Oregon ate one on a dare, and he died from it.
Well,
so basically, if you're not
so
eating
dumb.
It,
if you're not that dumb, then you won't die.
Yeah. So don't eat them. That's the thing.
Yeah. Well, who would want to anyway in their right mind?
I don't think they would taste too good either.
No. So what about the differences between toads and frogs?
Toads and frogs, that's another big one. Because you hear that a lot and people think it's a little bit more confusing than newts and salamanders, because toad is kind of used real loosely. It's a common name for lots of different families of frogs, and sometimes even within one family, some of them will be called frogs, and other ones will be called toads. But in the U.S., most of the toads, or how we usually think of them, is these warty, drier frogs with smaller hind legs, so they don't jump as far. And that's one family of toads, the Bufonidae. So they're called the true toads. And that's mostly what we think of when we hear the word toad. But worldwide, there are toads that look completely different, and they're still called quote-unquote toads. So
they're really generalized terms that really mean very little, practically.
More of just a confusion with the common names, yeah. In South, well, I grew up in Alabama and Florida, and I was just thinking this recently, that some of the Alabamians would call these blue-tailed lizards, they were skinks, they would call them scorpions. It was a common name for this lizard. But
wow.
They knew very well what true scorpions were. They knew scorpions with the stinger, but they also called that group of lizards scorpions. So.
Oh, it just argues for how confusing common names are, and we should probably just call everything by its Latin name and do away with such confusion.
Yeah, or like the bird people, they standardized the common names, and that would help too.
Yeah, it would. So how many different species of amphibians do we have on the Olympic Peninsula?
We have 13 species of amphibians. Let's see, five of those are frogs. And most people are more familiar with the frogs than they are with salamanders, because salamanders a lot of times spend time underground and out of view. Probably the most common frog people know of is the Pacific tree frog. which is usually the only one you hear calling, and they will call off and on throughout the year. The hylids, the tree frogs, are kind of shaped like, I think, Kermit the Frog. They're real skinny, elongate, skinny legs. And out here, they're either green, sometimes they're brownish, and they can actually change from green to brown.
What's the preferred word? I've heard them described as Pacific chorus frogs and as tree frogs. Are they both used interchangeably?
Yeah, up to about maybe 5 years ago, they were in the chorus frog genus, which is what they kind of look like if you're familiar with southeastern chorus frogs. They're a little bit less arboreal than the genus of true tree frogs, which if you've ever been to Florida or something, you'll see all these tree frogs hanging on windows and walls at night, which our tree frog really doesn't do. But there was a recent genetic study, and the study put our tree frog, which was chorus frog, closer to the or in the Hyla or tree frog genus. So technically it's Pacific tree frog, although a lot of herpetologists don't like that change because it looks like a chorus frog, and they still call them chorus frogs. So it does confuse things.
Huh. And they're the ones that are so prevalent in our ponds in the spring that they just have such a outstanding din that you can hardly hear yourself think if you're right next to a pond.
Yeah, and they can be really loud. Some people who are from the East Coast sometimes say, refer to them as peepers. There's a spring peeper in the East. That sound, sometimes when they're chorusing, they can sound a bit like that. But if you hear a single one, they sometimes sound like your thumb run over a comb sort of tone. Whereas the other frogs out here, you frequently don't hear. The western toad will sometimes peep like a bird. It's really kind of weird when you hear one. But they don't seem to do it much. But they peep almost like a chick,
huh.
Chicken chick. And then the red-legged and Cascades frogs typically call underwater. They
wow.
will sit on the bottom of the pond, and they'll do their little guttural calls, and I guess all the other frogs are under there listening underwater, which is really weird.
Well, probably the sound carries a lot better in the water, and they're wanting to advertise to other frogs, not to us humans.
That's true, and then maybe it's that predators stalking the edge won't hear them as much, so that's probably a good idea. Interesting, there are frogs, you have calling males, you hear that they are calling to defend their little area and to attract females. But you also have males that will hang out near a calling frog and interrupt and jump on the female before she gets to the calling male.
You know, Patrick, we are running out of time for today. We're going to have to continue this discussion next month. So thanks so much for coming to speak with us about amphibians. And we are going to continue this talk next month and hear more about the rest of our lovely amphibians in this area.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, thanks.
We have a few upcoming natural history events to tell you about. If you are lucky enough to be listening to this at noon on Wednesday, the 21st, you can plan to go to the Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society's monthly meeting this evening at 7 p.m., where they will have guest Dr. Ian Miller speaking about dams and dirt, the shoreline and nearshore responses to the Elwha Dam removals.
They are also planning a birding and camping field trip next week to Nia Bay, starting on Thursday, the 29th of October, and running through Friday, the 30th. There promises to be, in their words, lots of, quote, good bird babbling, unquote. To learn more about either of these events, along with lots of other cool upcoming events, go to their website at olympicpeninsulaaudubon.org.
You can also join the Jefferson Land Trust's Natural History Society this Saturday, October 24th, for an outing to explore two parcels of protected land along the Duckabush River. To sign up and learn meeting place and time, please contact Pat Rothman at jltnatural@saveland.org.
And here's our mystery sound again. It is a red-legged frog, a relatively common medium to large-sized frog found in moist forests near cool ponds, lakes, and small streams, especially where aquatic vegetation provides good cover. There are two subspecies, the northern and the Californian, and it is the northern that we get in our area. It gets its name from the coloration of the underside of the hind leg, a color that can be translucent red to burgundy in adults and pale pink in juveniles. They breed during the winter, from January to March, but during the non-breeding season they can be found several hundred feet from permanent water. Their call is a series of 5 to 7 quiet, low-pitched notes, and the male is often submerged in 2 to 3 feet of water when he makes it. It is barely audible when it is made above water. Our thanks to the Cornell Labs CD, Frog and Toad Calls of the Pacific Coast, for the recording. And that's it for KPTC's Nature Now for the third week of October. Thanks very much for joining me, Charlie, and thanks to all of you for listening. Remember, if you missed any of our program or want to listen again, this program will be rebroadcast at 5 p.m. on Thursday, 11:30 on Saturday, and available as a podcast in a week or so at kptz.org. And if you enjoyed this program and the rest of KPTZ's offerings every week, please consider becoming a sustaining member of this station. Our fall fund drive starts next week, but you can win additional valuable prizes if you join before the drive officially starts on October 25th. Go to kptz.org for details. As always,
happy trails!
Nature Now is produced by Nan Evans and edited by Charlie Fleischman.
Closing music today is Amphibian by Kristen Shout and Smoking Kitten.
Amphibian.